Warning, the following program may be too truthful for some liberals. Listener discretion is therefore advised.
And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar, your host, and what a special show we have today. Larry Elder is going to be joining us in just a minute. He is the author of The 10 Things You Can't Say in America, as well as What's Race Got to Do with It. He's here to talk to us about his latest book, Dear Father, Dear Son, Two Lives, 8 Hours. Larry, welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour.
Mark, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Oh, enjoy. I've wanted to have you on for a long time, and this book gave me the perfect excuse to hit on your publicist for an interview, so I did it. I have to tell you that as I got into the book, and I'm going to be honest with you and the listeners, I'm about a third of the way through, there was so much in this book that reminded me of what being a father used to be like in America, that tough, rough exterior that they used to portray to the world. Do you think that your father being somewhat harsh as he was something unique to him, or do you just see it as the way dads were in that particular time in America?
Well, Mark, it's the way dads were at that time in America. You know, my dad is from the generation that Tom Brokaw calls the greatest generation. My dad was what I call a junkyard dog dad. He was a Marine, and as a black man, he was one of the first Marines. They were the Montford Point Marines, the equivalent of the Tuskegee Airmen. And so my dad was just a rough, tough guy, Mark, and I got to tell you, I couldn't stand the SOB growing up, nor could my two brothers. And I assumed it was him. I thought that he was just ill-tempered and got mad at the slightest little thing. I thought he punished us too harshly, too quickly. And I was just counting the days until I got physically big enough that I was going to beat the crap out of him. So I'm 15 years old, and I describe in the book, for reasons that I mention, he and I have this fight, and we don't speak for 10 years. And then I'm 25 years old, and again, for reasons I describe in the book, I sit down, and I figured I'd have maybe a 10-minute conversation with him. I would tell him off, he would tell me off, and at least we'd clarify our positions. That's what I thought would happen. Instead, for the very first time, my dad talked about his father, and for some reason, all my life, there was this kind of no-fly zone over talking about my dad's private life. We just never did it. And in 8 hours, he morphed from being this mean, rough, tough SOB to this kind, caring, sensitive guy whom I completely misunderstood. I just misread the exterior for lack of love when, in fact, it was just the way he was. My father didn't know who his biological father was. The name Elder was the name of the boyfriend who was in his life the longest. His mother had a series of abusive, bad boyfriends, one of whom quarreled with my dad when my dad was 13 years old. The mother sides with the boyfriend, throws my dad out of the house. This is a black guy a year or two before the start of the Great Depression, Jim Crow South, Athens, Georgia, never to return home. And my dad, despite this upbringing, always told my brothers and me, hard work wins. You get out of life what you put into it. And no matter how hard you work, bad things are ultimately going to happen to you. And how you respond to those bad things will tell us whether or not your mother and I raised a man. And I said to him, how did you survive? How did you not get angry? Why aren't you racist? Why aren't you anti-white? Why haven't you picked up an AK-47 and mowed down people? He said, we didn't do that then. There was no body of people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton running around telling us that we were inferior because we were black, and there was no welfare. And he said, welfare is probably the worst thing that ever came down the pike. He said, to financially reward girls into having bad decisions and you're allowing boys to abandon their financial and moral responsibility, he considered that to be the moral equivalent of a drive-by shooting.
Larry, I was going to say this for the end of the interview, but since you've kind of taken us in this direction, I want to ask you about something. I was online last night, and just one of my little hobbies is I like to spank liberals before I go to bed on Twitter. So that's what I do.
Don't we all?
They don't seem to feel it. They don't. But yeah. It keeps me sharp for the show, so I like to see what they're thinking, which usually isn't very much. But at any rate, I got into a long, heated debate yesterday evening with a white liberal attorney, and I was trying to convince him that what's been done to African Americans in this country with the welfare programs is one of the most racist things I've ever seen in my life. First of all, it assumes that black people can't, you know, make it on their own without some kind of help from whitey. And secondly, if you go back to what LBJ said when he was asked, actually confronted by two Democratic governors on Air Force One about his civil rights legislation and his Great Society program and his welfare program, he said, "I'm going to have those blacks voting Democrat for the next 200 years." Only LBJ was a racist, so he didn't say blacks. He used the N-word. So the scary thing for me, Larry, is that we are now a little over 50 years into LBJ's prediction, and so far he's right. So are these policies holding black people back, or are they helping black people the way white liberals seem to think they are?
Well, the answer is they're holding not only black people back, but the country back.
Sure.
As I mentioned, this welfare state has attacked not only black families, but all families. Walter Williams had a column just the other day, and he said, if you look at census data, 1890 to 1940, a black child was more likely to be born in a nuclear intact family than a white child.
Mm-hmm.
And so this damage to the family is relatively new. In 1965, when Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty, 25% of black children were born outside of wedlock. The number is now triple that. And in 1965, 5 years before, around the same time Johnson launched the war on poverty, Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote a book called The Negro Family, A Case for National Action. And again, at 25% out of wedlock birth, he thought this was a horrific number, and if the country didn't do something about it, there was going to be a meltdown in the black community, and it was going to hurt the country in general. Well, fast forward now, 35% of white kids are born outside of wedlock, or 10 points higher than that alarmist number that Moynihan gave. Now, why was it alarmist then, but it's not alarmist now? And the answer is it remains alarmist, but the left cannot say to themselves, for 50 years I've been advocating the wrong policies, so let's blame poverty, let's blame racism, let's blame high-capacity magazines, let's blame anything other than what we've done to this country.
Let me go back for just a minute, because I didn't mean to get away from the book, but I want my listeners, before we go on, to get a feel for just what it was like in your house. Now, one of the ways I think we might can do that is, Larry, go back to when you were a little boy. I feel like I'm an analyst and you're on a couch now, but go back to when you were a little boy and your mother would say, "Larry, just wait till your father gets home." What did that do to you?
Well, it sent a chill down my spine and down the spines of my brother and me, because we thought of our father, and not just our father, but all the fathers we knew in our neighborhood, as the guy who came home and administered punishment for whatever you did that day. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad model. I'm just saying that's just the way it was. And we were terrified of our fathers because we, of course, always did bad things. I have two brothers, and we were rambunctious, and my mother would make my father hand out the punishment. When I got older, as I said, and I began to appreciate that. I began to appreciate and understand that was the way he did it. That was his model. I would not do it that way when and if I'm lucky enough to have children. But the point is, Mark, he was there. And that example of getting up and going to work every day when you don't feel like it, the example of interacting with your spouse, of resolving disputes without yelling, without screaming, this is what kids lack when they don't have a father in the house. When you don't have a father in the house and you're a boy, physically, when you get to be 10 or 11 years old, your mother can't control you. You have a distrustful relationship with men. If you're a girl, oftentimes a girl will gravitate towards the first man that shows her love, and God forbid this guy should be a bad person. So not having a father in the house hurts boys, it hurts girls. There are all sorts of studies that show that. And, you know, one of the guys that I interviewed was Kwesi Mfume, the former head of the NAACP. And I said to him, "Mr. Mfume, as between the presence of white racism, which you often talk about, or the absence of black fathers, which poses the bigger threat to the black community?" And to his credit, without missing a beat, Mark, he said, "The absence of black fathers." Now, I'm from South Central Los Angeles. I went to Crenshaw High School. That was a school that was featured in the movie Boys in the Hood.
Mm.
The director's a guy named John Singleton. In that movie, he followed two families. The first family was the family of Cuba Gooding Jr., whose father was actively involved in his life. He was spared gang activity. The other family was the one across the street, Ice Cube, whose father was not involved in his life, and one of his brothers was killed, and he was later on killed because of gang activity. And if that's too subtle, John Singleton did another movie called Baby Boy, which came on after that, which talked about the sex sexual predatory behavior of young black men, including Tupac Shakur, a Snoop Dogg, and some other guy who had two different kids by two different women, neither of whom he married. And so John Singleton is talking about what's going on. Tupac Shakur, in that documentary, Resurrection, where he said, I know for a fact that if I had had a father in my life, I would have had some discipline, I would have had more confidence. He's talking about this. So people in the streets are talking about this. The politicians are not listening. And one more thing, Mark, in the 80s, the L.A. Times, not exactly a right-wing rag, put out a poll, and they asked both poor people and non-poor people the following question. Do you believe that young poor women often have children to get welfare benefits? Not too surprisingly, the majority of non-poor people said no to that. 44% of those said young poor women often did, but the majority did not agree with that. However, when poor people were asked the question, do you believe young poor women often have children to get welfare benefits, 64% of poor people said young poor women often did this. So they're telling us what's going on, we're just not listening.
I've got to tell you, this also ties into another one of my Twitter battles, and that is, this whole concept of welfare wanting to make the welfare system making the situation worse. And what I mean by that is, you're discussing how somebody that's already got a child out of wedlock looks at the numbers and says, "Gee, if I have two or three more, I'll get a bigger check." And a story that ran in a Texas paper, probably 20 years ago. It was about this woman, single mom, and she had decided she was sick of being, on the government dole, sick of drawing the welfare check. So she studied and got her GED. Then she prepared for the SAT, did very well on it, and was able to get a scholarship so she could attend college, hopefully get out, get a job, and make her life better. Well, what did the welfare people do? They said, hey, wait a minute, that scholarship, that's income. If you accept that, we're going to have to cut you off of welfare. So given a choice between feeding her child and going to college, she had to stick with, feeding her child. So it seems to me that there are disincentives for bettering yourself within the welfare program, and there are rewards for irresponsible behavior, like continuing to have more kids out of wedlock. Again, I'd hate to think that anybody would be this evil, but I mentioned LBJ, Larry. When you go back to his comments from the 1960s, early 1960s, he never said blacks were in slavery for 300 years, and they've been discriminated against ever since we had this country. Even now, they don't have full equal rights. We've got to help black people make something out of themselves and become productive members of community. No, we're going to get them on welfare, and we're going to keep them voting Democrat for the next 200 years. When you look at the way welfare is set up in America, it almost seems like the plan is to get people on but never get them off. Your thoughts?
Well, whatever his motive is, the incentives have been perverse. And we've seen this in 1996 when Bill Clinton reluctantly signed the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 over the objections of people on the left of his party, people like John Lewis, who said it was going to be an assault on the poor. People were predicting there would be a rise in abortion. Surprise, surprise, the welfare rolls declined by over 50%, far more steeply than even the most optimistic predictions were, without a corresponding increase in abortion. It turned out there were a bunch of able-bodied and able-minded people on the couch, and they got off once they saw that the train was leaving the station. So we know what works.
Larry, I want to get back to your dad for a second. Now, he was very rough, very tough, former Marine, the kind of guy that I could imagine growled a lot. But
right.
As I read between the lines of your book, I started picking out little things. He had bought a ball for the kids to play with. He had bought an Erector set. He had bought a truck, even though he eventually broke it by kicking it against a wall. He
right.
bought an air rifle. Was it for you, I believe? So,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, in between all that huffing and puffing and growling and spanking with the alligator belt and the phone cord, it seemed like the guy did care enough about you to buy you things.
Absolutely. And remember, this is the guy who busted his tail. He worked two full-time jobs as a janitor. He cooked for a family on the weekend and went to night school three nights a week to get his GED because, as I mentioned, he was thrown out of the house when he was 13, never to return to school. So the guy averaged maybe 4.5 hours of sleep for decades and still managed to be the father to the extent that he could and with, you know, with the skills that he was given when he grew up. Absolutely. And the reason I wrote the book is that I wanted to be a 247-page apology to the man, A, and B, I don't want other people to be lucky the way I was. I describe in the book why I sat down with him. It was a chance encounter with a man who knew my dad before my dad met my mother, and this man convinced me that I was reading my father wrong. Had I not met this man who turned out to be my uncle, I don't know that I ever would have sat down with my father with a much more open mind. So I want other kids not to do this. While your dad is still alive, while he's still walking around, no matter how he treated you, how you resolve, how you think about him is going to be a point reflection on how you think about yourself, and that in turn will impact how you treat other people. So you still need to get that resolved. There's something you can do when he's still around. Once he's dead, there's nothing you can do about it. So you can reach out. He may not reach back. He may not reach back yet, but at least there's something that you can do to at least clarify your position. And I would urge all men and all girls to do that while the old man is still around.
Larry, I'm going to have to paraphrase, but Mark Twain once said something to the effect of, before he went to college, he thought his old man was one of the dumbest people he had ever met, and when he got out of college, he thought his dad was one of the smartest people he had ever met, and he jokingly said, I was surprised at how much my old man had learned in just 4 years. Sounds to me like, because of that chance meeting, you've come away with a totally different view on your dad, and maybe you've got a lot more respect for him than you did before.
Oh, I sure do. And again, my dad was an amazing guy, but his story was not atypical, and that's the other point I want to make. My father was not particularly heroic. He did exactly what he felt he should do. He lived up to his responsibilities and doesn't think he deserves some sort of congressional medal for that. The other thing, Mark, is it bothers me that some of these so-called black leaders don't talk about the importance of fathers, especially given their own personal situations. In the case of Jesse Jackson, his mother was a 16-year-old teenage mom who was impregnated by the married man next door, and when Jesse Jackson was growing up, he was taunted by kids in South Carolina saying, Jesse ain't got no daddy, Jesse ain't got no daddy, and it hurt him. In the case of Sharpton was middle class until his father abandoned the family and then down to the ghetto. In the case of Farrakhan, Farrakhan's mother was estranged from her husband, had a boyfriend, took back up with the husband, got pregnant, didn't want the boyfriend to find out, so she tried to abort Farrakhan with a coat hanger. So all three of these men have had their lives scarred by their fathers or their absentee fathers, yet they don't speak about that. It's the white man this, the white man that, and oh, by the way, the white man this. It's absurd.
What's kind of interesting to me, Larry, regarding politics, is that you grew up liking your mom a whole lot more, yet she was a Democrat,
right.
Your dad was a Republican, and with you being a libertarian, dare I say your dad was a bigger influence on you.
Well, he was, but understand, my mother was a Jack Kennedy / Scoop Jackson type of Democrat. The last two election cycles, she actually voted for George W. Bush, even though she didn't change her registration. She felt that the party left her. She was not one of these tax hiking, anti-foreign policy, she was opposed to same-sex marriage. She was in favor of she was pro-life. She hated Roe v. Wade. She felt the Democratic Party had left their ideals, and so she quietly went into that voting booth and pulled the lever for the Republican Party. But emotionally, like a lot of black people, could not change parties.
I think we got a glimpse of that when she was particularly harsh to a Spanish gentleman who came in your dad's snack shop who could not speak English very well. She wasn't in favor of certain people being able to cross the border without going through the proper legal channels and then refusing to learn English.
Yeah, the sort of Marco Rubio Barack Obama debate that's going on right now took place in that cafe in the 60s between my mom and my dad.
Uh-huh.
My dad was very welcoming, but not so much because he believed in amnesty. He was welcoming because people were here and he wanted their money. My mother resented the fact that people came across the border without checking out and just walking in here illegally, and she resented and thought it was going to change the culture. And my dad said, "You might be right, but right now I'm a businessman. I want their money."
So he was a very practical guy.
That's right. He learned how to speak Spanish, and about a third of the clientele was Hispanic, about a third was white, and about a third was black. It's not too far from downtown L.A. right now where the cafe was. And my father saw that the community was changing. And again, my father said, I'm not Border Patrol. I'm not the president. All I am is a businessman. And so if people right here speak Spanish, I'm going to learn to speak Spanish to get their money. And my mother resented that. She felt that the customers should learn how to speak English. And my dad said, okay, stand out there and tell them to learn how to speak English if you want to. In the meanwhile, I want their money.
You know, as a guy with a business degree, I have to admit your dad's one of those people who understands that it's all about cash flowing at the end of the day, and put politics aside in order to make a buck. So it's hard not to see his viewpoint. Now, speaking of your dad and the Hispanic community that surrounded his snack shop, Elder's Snack Bar, I guess is what it, okay. And he at one point saw the neighborhood being almost controlled by Hispanic gangs,
right.
Yet they all left him alone. He, you know, didn't have anyone ever walk in his store with a gun. At the end of the day, every day he would walk to his car with a big bag of money. You even tell a story in the book about him handing the money to someone and they held it for him while he opened his trunk or got his car ready or whatever. So what do you think about the fact that your dad was in the middle of this gang-infested neighborhood? He was African-American. Most of the gangs were Hispanic, but he was so respected that they never touched him.
It was a wild scene, Mark. Some of the largest gangs in the country are located at that area of South Central Los Angeles. One of them is called the MS-13 gang. One of them is called the 18th Street gang. This is some vicious gangs in the area where my dad's cafe was. My dad, the reason he built the cafe is that that's the house where I lived for the first 7 years of my life. So my dad had a presence in that community for almost 50, 60 years. And when he started the cafe, he gave these kids ice cream for free out of the back of the restaurant. Again, not to be a politician, not because he wanted to fast forward down the road, inoculate himself from gang violence. That's just how my dad was. And so all these guys remember this. And so now they're 18, 20, 25, 30 years old, and they remember how my father used to give them free candy and free ice cream when they were kids. And so they would not allow anybody to harm my father. And so my father literally would leave the cafe every night with a bag of money, as you pointed out, and these guys would be at his car making sure he would be protected. My dad would hand one of the gang members the bag. He would open the car. The guy would politely hand him the bag back. Everybody knew it was full of cash. Nobody took a dime, and my dad would go off home.
I love that story. That is so interesting. My grandfather ran a little Italian grocery store in the middle of an African-American community, and I can say that he did a lot of the same things. He would give candy to the kids because that's just the way he was. You mentioned that your dad would sometimes, you know, float people a little credit when they couldn't afford to pay.
Right.
My grandfather did the same thing, and the exact same story. There for decades, store never robbed once. So there's something to be said for treating people as you would have them treat you. I got to tell you, I look at that picture of your dad's snack bar, and you know, I have to ask you, is it still there?
The building is still there, and the guy that bought it has converted it into a location where he fixes appliances. So if you walk in there right now, you see a bunch of washing machines, refrigerators, and things like that. But he remembers my father, and everybody remembers my father's legacy in that corner because people were able to get really good food, and he was always open on time. He never came in sick. He never missed a day of work in the whole 35, almost 40 years he ran the place. And one of the things real quickly, Mark, that my dad and I talked about in the book, Dear Father, Dear Son, was a story about a prison chaplain who one time wanted to improve the morale at the penitentiary where he worked. So he went to a greeting card company, got 500 free Mother's Day cards, and went back to the penitentiary, gave them to the men, and they filled them out and sent them off to their mothers. And morale did indeed improve. So he thought he would do the same thing for Father's Day. And you know where I'm going with this story, Mark. He goes to the greeting card company, he gets 500 Father's Day cards. Not one inmate, true story, not one inmate wanted to fill one of these cards out and send it to his father. Now, what does that tell you?
Tells you about the importance of a male role model.
Yeah,
absolutely. And, of course, you know, I'm still waiting for Hallmark to come out with a baby daddy card if they don't already have it.
don't give me any ideas.
You're right. Well, they'll probably use it and not give me any royalties. So that's the way it usually goes. I have to ask you this because as much as you thought of your dad as being an SOB, I'm catching a lot of positive traits coming out of this man as I read your book. And I got to be honest, I there are a lot of positive traits in you as well, my friend. How much of your success today, which has been phenomenal, would you say is owed to the values that this SOB instilled in you as you were growing up?
It's an interesting question. The other day, we had a death in the family, and somebody that I hadn't seen in a long time, named Doris, the woman I describe in the book as my sister, visited us. And she looked at me and she said, "You look just like your dad." And I got to tell you, Mark, when I was, before 25 years old, when I sat down with my dad and had this revelation, if anybody had said I looked like my dad, that would not have been a compliment to me. That would not have been a compliment that I would have taken, because not because I thought my father was unattractive, but I just didn't want to have anything to do with him, didn't want to be reminded of him, didn't want people to look at me and think that I reminded him of my father. This time when she said, "Larry, you look just like my dad," I had a big, big megawatt smile. So to answer your question, I ran a business. I started running a business when I was 27 years old. And one day I exploded at my employees in a rant very reminiscent of the kind of rant my dad used to unleash on me. And I remember being shocked by that. And I came in the next day, I apologized to my employees. I said, "I will never do it again." And I never did it again. But my point is, imagine having about four and a half hours average of sleep year after year after year. What kind of hair trigger temper do you have then? And in my case, I didn't have that kind of excuse. It was a day that I had just had it, and I don't even remember what was going on. My point is, I had the same kind of anger outburst that my dad had, the kind of outburst that made me feel that he didn't love me. And it wasn't that I didn't love my staff. I just was upset that day, so I understood it. And so it made me even empathize a little bit more with the pressure he was under. I'm not a father of three kids the way my dad was. I didn't have a stay-at-home wife the way my dad did. I wasn't running the kind of business that my dad was running. Can you know, add all that up, and his pressure was exponentially way more than mine was, and I exploded. So I understood him a lot more because of that.
I think one thing we can all say about our fathers, Larry, is that, and our parents, our moms and our dads, is that they did their best job raising us. I mean, they did the best they could raising us. And I think for me, the real eye-opener came because I was pretty critical of my dad for a long time, and he wasn't quite as harsh and as gruff as your dad, but, you know, he had his moments. And I think what changed me and what really opened up my relationship with my dad again after being a know-it-all teenager was whenever I finally became a father myself. And I remember one day I was at my parents' home, and my brother was just unleashing on my dad more than my mom, but kind of at both parents about, "Well, you know, when you raised us, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, blah, blah, blah." And I already had, I guess at that time, probably a 10 or 12-year-old, and my, you know, I want to say he was about 12, and my brother didn't have kids yet. And I told him, I said, "You know, kids don't come with a set of instructions, and I have a feeling when you've been a parent for a few years, you're going to think back on this conversation, and you're going to realize that all parents do the best job they can with what they have." And, or, you know, and that's kind of, that was kind of my eye-opener. For you, it was your dad, you know, sitting down and talking with your dad. You mentioned that you're not a parent yet. But for me, it was becoming a parent and feeling all that pressure and realizing that even when my son was probably 5 or 6, I had already made mistakes. I already had done things I wish I could take back. And, but we all make those mistakes. But hopefully people out there will follow your advice, and if you do not have a great relationship with your mom, with your dad, go see what you can do to figure out why, and you know, maybe you'll understand your parents a little bit more. This is a fantastic book. It's called Dear Father, Dear Son, 2 Lives, 8 Hours. Tell the folks at home exactly how they can get a copy of this.
The easiest way is to go to my website, Mark, LarryElder.com. That's LarryElder.com, or you can go to Amazon.com and order it.
Well, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to put you up on our webpage, get a nice picture of you in the book, and we'll have a link to your website so that people can just click on it, go there, and order that. And now you're in radio. Tell the folks how they can listen to you. Is it available over the Internet?
It is. Go to KADC.com, again, or LarryElder.com. My show comes on every afternoon from 3 to 6 Pacific time.
Very good. Larry, it has been an absolute honor having you here today. I have to tell you that as I read this book, I started looking up the other books you have written, and I'm embarrassed to say that I have not read your previous two bestsellers, but this one is so well written. You know, when I finish this one, I'm going to go out and grab two more. So
sounds great. I always say we have a country to save. I have a mortgage to pay, so feel free.
Well, yeah, we can talk about saving the country on a different day.
Right.
that's at least an hour show in and of itself. Once again, Larry, it's been an absolute honor having you here. Much success with the book, and I look forward to having you back sometime.
Mark, anytime. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar.